We'll hear arguments first this morning in Smith against Robinson. Mr. Larson, you may proceed whenever you are ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the Court. This case involves petitioner's entitlement to attorney's fees under 42 U.S.C. Section 1988 in this action to enforce constitutional rights through Section 1983. This case also involves fee entitlement under Section 505B of the Rehabilitation Act in this action brought to enforce and to charge a violation of Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act. As in Blum v. Stenson, decided unanimously by this Court last week, resolution of this case begins and ends with the legislative history accompanying these fee provisions, a legislative history in which Congress stated that plaintiffs need not prevail on a substantial constitutional claim or on another overlapping fee claim in order to be entitled to fees. This case, we submit, is further controlled by this Court's unanimous decision in Marr v. Gagne, a decision in which this Court not only conclusively applied the foregoing legislative history, but indeed it is the same legislative history that is applicable here. And in that case, this Court held that a plaintiff who never obtained a ruling on her substantial constitutional claim nonetheless was entitled to fees under Section 1988. In this case, petitioner Tommy Smith is a physically and emotionally handicapped child who walks with the aid of leg braces and crutches due to cerebral palsy. Tommy was 8 years old when this litigation was commenced in 1976. Tommy, at that time, was enrolled in a special education day program approved by the respondents and paid for by the school committee as part of their education program. This litigation was commenced when the local school committee, with the subsequent approval and support of the respondents, proposed to exclude Tommy from receiving an education solely because of the nature of his handicap. Respondents' consistent litigation position throughout this litigation has been that the school committees, including the local school committee here, and the respondents had no responsibility for educating Tommy or similarly situated persons who had an emotional handicap. Petitioner's complaint alleged three substantial federal claims. Initially, there were constitutional claims. Indeed, the opening complaint alleged only constitutional claims. This was a due process claim. The petitioner was being excluded, being denied an education with no hearing whatsoever, and also an straight equal protection claim that petitioner was being denied an education, excluded from an education, in violation of equal protection. Petitioners also alleged a federal claim under Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act, the language of which specifically precludes the exclusion of a person from receiving federal benefits or in a program supported by federal monies solely on the basis of handicap. A third federal claim was also alleged in this case, the 75 Handicapped Act. After the act became effective and subsequent to plaintiffs' success on their constitutional claims, plaintiffs added a claim that the respondents had violated the Education for All Handicapped Children Act of 1975. Now, there's no question in this case about the appropriateness of the education that was designed for Tommy. It's simply a question of exclusion versus non-exclusion. There also is no question in this case that petitioners, in fact, prevailed. They prevailed initially and throughout the litigation on their due process claim, and they ultimately prevailed primarily as a result of a certified decision by the Rhode Island Supreme Court.
Mr. Larson, you say that your clients prevailed throughout the litigation on their due process claim. I didn't read Judge Campbell's opinion as necessarily agreeing with that.
The characterization of Judge Campbell's opinion or that in the opinion, is that we ultimately prevailed as a matter of the Education for All Handicapped Children Act.
Yeah.
Judge Campbell does not disagree whatsoever that throughout the course of this litigation, it was the preliminary injunction entered on the due process claim pursuant to which plaintiffs through the course of the litigation prevailed.
Well, what is the difference between prevailing through the course of the litigation and ultimately prevailing? I take it from your argument you see those as two different things.
No, I'm just saying that there is no question on this record whatsoever, Justice Rehnquist, about the fact that the plaintiffs prevailed. Under Hensley,
But the Court of Appeals seems to have held otherwise.
Oh, no. I don't believe that there is any question that the Court of Appeals viewed the plaintiff as having prevailed. Indeed, in the first decision to the First Circuit.
Well, I think the Court of Appeals agreed that the plaintiff prevailed without a doubt. But I read the Court of Appeals opinion as intimating that you prevailed on the EAHCA.
But that is belied by the record, Your Honor.
Well, but then you're arguing about a question of fact, really, where the Court of Appeals is against you, and we ordinarily don't review questions of fact.
Justice Rehnquist, it doesn't matter with regard to the statutory threshold that plaintiffs must meet under Hensley v. Eckerhart how plaintiffs happen to prevail here. The matter of fact and found by the district court is that plaintiffs did prevail. Indeed, our opponents at the fee hearing admitted that we had obtained the objective sought in the lawsuit and that we accordingly were the prevailing party.
I don't suppose anyone disputes that, but I think what the First Circuit says is you prevailed on the EAHCA count. That's an all-embracing statutory claim that really covers everything you could have gotten on your constitutional counts, and since that doesn't provide for attorney's fees, you can't get them.
The First Circuit's decision on the fee issue is different from the First Circuit's decision on defendants' appeal on their motion to dismiss. On the first decision, the First Circuit states that plaintiffs had obtained the objective of their lawsuit as a matter of state law. That's on the merits. Subsequently, in the collateral fee proceeding, the First Circuit basically stated that the plaintiffs had prevailed both as a matter of state law and as a matter of the Education for All Handicapped Children Act, ultimately prevailed.
Mr. Lawson, did not the district court, after the decision of the state Supreme Court, say that you had prevailed as a result of the state decision?
The district court,
in
its final order on the merits, held that we had obtained the objective of our lawsuit.
That you'd obtained all of the relief you sought.
That's correct.
As a result of the state decision.
That's correct.
And was it not after that decision was made by the district court that you filed your Second Amendment and alleged a 1983 action?
No, that's not correct, Your Honor.
When did you first file that?
The Second Amended complaint was filed after the summer of 1980, the June 1980 decision by the Rhode Island Supreme Court. That was 1 year before the final order on the merits.
But it was after the decision of the Supreme Court of the state.
That's correct. And that nonetheless related back to, I mean, it was a motion to file a second amended complaint, which was granted and which relates back to the...
But the point is, hadn't you obtained all the relief you sought before you filed your amended complaint?
Not necessarily. On certification, the decision by the Rhode Island Supreme Court is essentially an advisory opinion. There was a period in which we had to determine whether or not there indeed was going to be compliance. Now, there was never any injunction entered against the respondents directing compliance. There was a January 1981 injunction issued against the consent injunction issued against the school committee requiring their compliance. It was indeed ascertained that compliance would be obtained. Plus, there was the outstanding matter of attorney's fees. The defendants tried to get out of this lawsuit because they saw attorney's fees coming.
But was there a substantial issue left after the decision of the state Supreme Court?
The matter of compliance? Yes. Plus, there is also the matter that the record in this case, the state hearing officer decision was still on the record in this case, and that plaintiffs had a right to have that decision basically stricken or recognized as not controlling. And that is indeed something that happened in the final order.
On the same point, I also fail to understand what happened and why there was a year's worth of litigation after the state Supreme Court issued its ruling, which furnished the only basis for the ultimate ruling in the federal court.
It's true, Justice Conner, that a year in time passed. There was not a year of litigation. Immediately after the state Supreme Court opinion, the motion for an amended complaint was filed. That was granted shortly thereafter. This is basically July. The amended complaint was then actually filed in the fall. And then we're into the winter when motions began to be filed to complete the matter of relief in this case. During that period of time, the petitioners and the school committee worked out a consent decree, basically, which included the award of attorney's fees against the school committee. The state, however, was not so sure that it was going to go along, and it looked like further litigation might be necessary against the respondents in this case.
On what? The fee?
Well, basically, the petitioners wanted a ruling on federal law. They, of course, did not obtain it because the district court judge in his final order said that we don't have to reach the federal law issues because the district court recognizes the plaintiff has obtained the objective of the lawsuit.
You made two different types of due process claims during the course of the litigation.
That's correct.
One was against the local school committee, and that was basis
but that was also
of the original injunction, I guess. The preliminary injunction.
Yes, an injunction which was continued also against the state.
Yeah, but
that was
really a complaint concerning the termination of funding pending resolution of the dispute against the school committee.
The termination of Tommy's education.
For the child's education.
That's correct.
All right. And then the second due process claim was against the respondents here and had to do with their serving as hearing officers in your dispute with the school committee.
It was a Gibson v. Berryhill type claim challenging the bias in the process itself, yes.
And no relief was granted under that claim.
That's correct. But the first claim, the due process claim, we believe runs against the respondents as well because of the modified preliminary injunction that was subsequently entered after the respondents were in this case.
Well, but didn't the terms of the preliminary injunction run only against the school committee?
Initially, yes. But, of course, I mean, the state was involved in the funding of this process. The state has the responsibility for enforcing state law.
Well, but the terms of the injunction did not run against these respondents, did it?
As state actors acting in cooperation with the local defendants.
Well, did it or not,
it
in terms of the words of the preliminary injunction?
In the words of the preliminary injunction, it's only against the school committee.
You said a moment ago that it ran initially only against the school. I gathered from your answer that perhaps later it was amended to
yes.
run. Is that what you meant?
It was
could you answer the question?
Yes. The original preliminary injunction was directed solely against the school committee because, indeed, the respondents had not yet been sued. And the terms of the preliminary injunction were to maintain Tommy in his educational program during the pendency of the exhaustion of the administrative procedures. Thereafter, it was extended because the administrative procedures ended
in 1978. I don't think you're answering my question. I asked you when you answered initially to Justice O'Connor, I got the implication that at some later point the injunction was amended to
yes,
run against the state defendants as well.
Well, the state defendants...
Now, is that true or not? Is that correct or not?
As Justice O'Connor pointed out, it did not name the state.
So it never
injunction.
Did run in terms against the state defendants?
In that they were co-actors responsible in this
Were
litigation.
They named in the injunction?
No.
Mr. Larson, could I bring you back to something you started off with, and that was your reference to Meyer against Gagne.
Correct.
The First Circuit mentioned it once in its opinion, as I recall.
That's correct.
Just once in a sort of passing way. Do you think they overlooked it or didn't want to face up to Meyer against Gagne or what?
I certainly
think... Maybe I should ask your opponent that question.
Well... I certainly do believe they overlooked it. There was no analysis of it whatsoever. And plus, of course, in Marr, this court set out the relevant legislative history of Section 1988 And the First Circuit never mentioned that legislative history whatsoever. I think they may have been unaware of the legislative history or unwilling to look at it.
Well, if we thought that was error and vacated the opinion and sent it back, would it be open on remand for the application of the Hensley principles announced last term?
The Hensley principles, even pre-Hensley, were applied by the district court. For example,
Justice O'Connor. Well, it doesn't appear to have been.
Well, Justice O'Connor, you referred to the fact that the substantive due process claim with regard to the Gibson v. Berryhill issue was not one on which plaintiffs prevailed. The district court deducted the fees or the time spent on that issue from the fee award that was granted. There is a type of Hensley issue still pending in the First Circuit. I wouldn't really consider it a Hensley issue, but it has to do with whether or not the time that was spent in the administrative proceeding and in the state court proceeding is correctly time which should be compensated in this litigation. That was not addressed by the First Circuit in this appeal because of the way that the First Circuit disposed of the fee entitlement issue. That issue, of course, would be open on remand.
Mr. Lawson, I'm afraid we're not giving you much time to argue the case, but the point that I asked you about before is central to my own understanding of the case. Let me ask you one more question. After your view had prevailed in the state Supreme Court, and you, of course, had to go back to the district court because the questions had been certified to the state court.
That's correct.
Did you ask the district court on your return to it to give you any relief that the state Supreme Court had not given you?
There was a motion filed with regard to the due process claim involving
motion filed, was this in your complaint that had already been filed sometime before, or did you what did you request specifically when you went back?
We requested that the hearing process itself be declared violative of due process because of interested persons acting as hearing officers. We sought further relief on that, and we were denied that. That is in the complaint, and it was part of a separate motion subsequent to the Rhode Island Supreme Court's decision.
The district court, though, still said that you had won everything you ever sought.
There's no question that the major issue in this case was Tommy's education. I think the district court was correct in its finding of fact that plaintiffs had obtained the results sought, and I think the First Circuit in its appeal on the merits was correct in also making that same finding of fact.
And you did not file your 1983 claim until after, according to the district court, you'd won everything the plaintiffs sought.
No, the 1983 claim was the first claim in the case.
Yes, but you've been paid for that work.
Oh, no. I mean, the 1983 equal protection claim, which the trial court found to be substantial, is a claim that is encompassed within the initial complaint that was filed, yes, against the school committee, but thereafter the respondents came in and stood in the shoes of the school committee. We know the responsibility of the state for education, and it came in, and the litigation continued thereafter.
But why was it necessary then for you to amend your complaint? The second amended complaint.
The first amended complaint added the Education for All Handicapped Children Act claim because that had then become an effective federal law. And the third amended complaint added the 504 claim.
And when did you add the Section 1988 claim?
The Section 1988 claim was in the First Amendment complaint and also in the Second Amendment complaint. Section 1988 with regard to fees, as a matter of fees law, need not necessarily be pled. There was a boilerplate request for such further relief in the first complaint, and that, in the courts of appeals, has been held as sufficient to encompass a request for fees. As I've stated, I believe that because of the legislative history and because of the unanimous decision by this court in Maher v. Gagne, this case is conclusively or should be resolved in favor of petitioners here.
On that point, Mr. Larson, the court didn't discuss, and I don't believe the briefs do, cases such as Brown against the GSA and Prizer versus Rodriguez, where this court has said that a detailed comprehensive statute precludes remedies under the broader 1983 type claim. And I wonder if that's applicable here with the Education for the Handicapped Act.
We believe that those cases are an opposite.
Why?
The First Circuit here applied Middlesex County. Middlesex County, with its comprehensiveness test, applies only to the and laws issue. There is no and laws issue here. The Education for All Handicapped Children Act is not being proposed to be asserted through the and laws language of 1983. It simply is not relevant. Nonetheless, a little bit more relevant, but still an opposite, are the preemption doctrine and the implication by repeal by implication doctrine. Now, all of those doctrines, I mean, both the preemption doctrine and the repeal by implication doctrine, as well as the Middlesex County comprehensiveness test, bottom out on legislative intent. Each of those tests is based upon legislative intent. Now, first of all, with regard to fees.
Well, can't you divine legislative intent by the fact that the Congress has enacted a very specific, detailed plan for these education of the handicap provisions and refer to that instead of 1983?
No, neither preemption nor repeal by implication allows this court to use a test without going to the legislative history. The test is a substitute for legislative history. For example, in Brown v. GSA, the court looked at the legislative history. And what had Congress done in 1972? It had said there is no remedy for employment discrimination in the federal sector because of sovereign immunity. I mean, it cited Blaze v. Moon in the Fifth Circuit. It cited a number of other sovereign immunity cases. Congress was aware from its perception that it was operating on a blank sheet, and it thereby enacted comprehensive legislation. The legislative history here is totally different in several respects. First of all, with regard to fees. The fee statutes at issue here were enacted, or Section 1988, was enacted in 1976, a year after the 75 Act. Section 505 was enacted 3 years later, in 1978. I mean, there is no doctrine of repeal by implication or preemption which allows a Congress sitting in 1975 to preempt acts that Congress takes in the future. With regard to the substantive rights, it is even less likely that Congress could have preempted for a variety of reasons. First of all, this is a spending statute, which is optional with the states. It's almost as if, I mean, to follow through on this preemption or repeal by implication argument, if it's worth anything, that Congress delegated to the states whether or not the states wanted to repeal the applicability of 504. If the state opts out of this, they're covered by 504. I mean, we know that New Mexico is not covered by the 1975 Handicapped Act, yet 504 and the 1983 fully apply there. I mean, it would be absolutely unheard of for Congress to delegate to the states the repeal of federal statutes, much less the enforcement of constitutional rights. And finally, of course, what is ultimately controlling is the legislative history itself. The legislative history. The Senate report alone has 22 paragraphs spanning 16 pages discussing the existence of pre-existing and concurrent remedies in this situation. There is absolutely full awareness of these pre-existing remedies. I mean, the case couldn't be farther away from Brown v. GSA. This is really a Jones v. Mayer type case or a Johnson v. REA type of case. Congress was aware, and it did not at all preempt or repeal by implication those remedies. There has to be a clear statement. It is not here whatsoever. We believe on the basis of Meagher v. Gagne that this case should be conclusively resolved in petitioner's favor. In Meagher, there was a substantial constitutional claim which was not addressed. There was also a substantial federal statutory claim which did not necessarily have a fee authorization attached to it. The plaintiffs were determined to have passed that statutory threshold of having prevailed without ever receiving an adjudication on their constitutional claim. And this court unanimously held that plaintiff, because of the fact that she had raised a substantial constitutional claim, was entitled to fees under Section 1988. And the same result flows here, not only under Section 1988, but also under Section 505. In conclusion, we believe that there is little question on this record and as a matter of law that the First Circuit erred here and the plaintiffs are entitled to fees. Now, as Justice O'Connor pointed out, this doesn't have anything to do with the amount of fees, which is still an issue or will be an issue on remand in the First Circuit. I would like to reserve the remainder of my time unless there are any questions.
Mr. Avila.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, I think that the Court has indicated some interest in the, in essence, the travel of this case, so I want to explain a little bit of the history of this so we see how this case came into focus. I want to point out here that I represent the Commissioner of Education and not the local school committee in this action.
What Mr. Avila, you mentioned travel of the case. Is this a Rhode Island expression?
I think common in the First Circuit too. I think it's, I see it all the time.
We've come across it in one other case, and
I was not aware that it was an unusual expression, Your Honor. That's always been our usual term for it.
Find it in California, anyway.
Well, in this case, long before the Commissioner of Education became involved in it, what happened was the local school committee agreed that the child concerned should be placed at Bradley Psychiatric Hospital. And so the school committee did that. Then the school committee looked at the situation and reevaluated it and made a determination that there was a state agency, the Rhode Island Department of Mental Health, that it felt under certain statutes was responsible for this child's, or should be responsible for educating or placing this child at Bradley Hospital. So the school committee told the parents that the school committee was not going to fund that placement, not going to provide any more funds for that placement, which of course would result in that placement being ended. At that point, what happened in the case was the plaintiffs in this action filed a complaint in the federal district court. And I don't believe that this first complaint speaks of equal protection, if I remember it correctly. I think it solely speaks to procedural due process, and more particularly, the basic argument of this complaint was simply that the Rhode Island regulations, Rhode Island special ed regulations, which, even though the Handicapped Act was not yet in effect, apparently we had some pre-knowledge of what these regulations would look like, so it looks as if the regulations we were using at the time really matched the ultimate federal handicap regulations. Under those regulations, a placement couldn't be changed unless the parents consented to it or unless they were granted a hearing, and as a result of that hearing, a change was ordered. Well, what happened in this case was the plaintiffs felt that they weren't going to be granted that hearing, even though they had asked for it. So they filed a complaint in federal district court, and the federal district court judge looked at the complaint and he said, yes, under Rhode Island regulations, you have a right to a hearing before the placement can be terminated, and this potential funding dispute between state agencies is exactly that sort of funding dispute or that sort of change of placement dispute that should be adjudicated through the available state administrative procedures. So the federal judge issued a preliminary injunction to keep the child at Bradley Hospital at the expense of the school committee and then required the school committee to conduct a due process hearing as required by Rhode Island Administrative Special Education Regulations, and also that opportunity should be given the parties to appeal to the Commissioner of Education. So that's what happened in this case, Your Honors. There was a hearing before the local school committee, an administrative sort of hearing. The school committee took evidence and looked at the matter, and they resolved in a written decision that they were not responsible because a state agency was responsible. That decision was then appealed to the Commissioner of Education, who held a de novo hearing, acting as a hearing officer, and listened to both sides. Now, the Rhode Island Supreme Court in a case, and by then, by the time the matter reaches the Commissioner of Education, the Handicapped Children's Act is in force. And you'll note if you look at the record, one of the complaints the plaintiffs had against the commissioner, and an issue on which they lost, they were arguing that he couldn't act as a hearing officer under the Education for All Handicapped Children's Act. So there was no doubt here. The plaintiffs have even agreed that this was a hearing pursuant to the Education for All Handicapped Children's Act at that stage. What happened was the commissioner heard the matter, and the Rhode Island Supreme Court had indicated at the time that this was a difficult question. It had not yet resolved the issue. So that left the commissioner in the position of having to make his own decision. And so what the commissioner did was he found that the Rhode Island Department of Mental Health should have been educating this child. That was his decision. Now, what happened after that was the plaintiffs appealed the matter to federal district court. They took the matter up there, arguing that it, you know, was not the school, was not the Department of Mental Health, but rather the school committee that should be responsible. Now, with that Rhode Island Supreme Court prior precedent that I mentioned, indicating this was a difficult issue, I was involved in the case at that point, and I suggested to the court that the matter, the question, be certified to the Rhode Island Supreme Court for determination as to who was responsible and who wasn't. And so then the Rhode Island Supreme Court came down with a decision indicating that in fact the local school committee was responsible. So in this case, I would suggest that what you really have, it's not a normal special ed case. What you have is a state level hearing officer who heard a case, and he decided the case in a way that ultimately was not, that was held to be wrong by the Rhode Island Supreme Court. Now, because he...
As a matter of state law?
As a matter of state law, Your Honor. And the strange thing about, I shouldn't say, the interesting thing about this case, if you read one of the later opinions of the district court in this matter, he said, what finally happened in this case was once the Rhode Island Supreme Court rendered its decision, which from my perspective ended it, I don't think you can presume that state agencies are not going to follow their own Supreme Court. Plaintiffs, though, perhaps wishing to have some sort of order on the record, looking forward to some sort of attorney's fees, requested a declaratory judgment declaring that the commissioner's decision was wrong. I still don't know the point of doing that other than trying to, form a basis for fees. Now, the court ultimately entered that sort of decision and declared for whatever purpose that the commissioner's decision was wrong. But that was, a decision by the Commissioner of Education really taken entirely, I would say, in essence, in his judicial capacity. And you'll note in one of the district court's opinions, the district court makes the point that it is not ruling against the commissioner, and it uses these words, on any basis that the commissioner ever failed to enforce state law or failed to see that state law was carried out. No, the court rejected that, said that was not the reason. It said the reason why it was acting in the case was because the commissioner had rendered this decision and it gave the date of the decision. So I would say there's no doubt that all we have in this case is a pure Education for All Handicapped Children's matter where a hearing officer acting under that act has rendered a certain decision.
May I go back to the beginning again? I want to be sure I have this thing in the right sequence. The very beginning of the litigation, as I understand it, the funds were about to be withdrawn and the child was about to be transferred to a different facility.
The funds were about to be withdrawn, and we don't know what the results would have been if that local school committee had withdrawn the funds.
But the allegation, the complaint was that there was a risk the child would be transferred, wasn't that right?
Well, I think
at least the funds were going to be withdrawn.
The funds were going to be withdrawn, which would terminate that placement. But the Rhode Island Commissioner of Education was not involved in the dispute, at that point.
I understand. But at that point, the district judge entered an injunction maintaining the status quo.
Yes, Your Honor, that's exactly what he did.
And that action rested entirely on federal law, did it not?
No, Your Honor. I would say if you look at his decision, he said that where the school committee has gone wrong in this case, it's not following state regulations. And I think failure to follow state regulations, and this may have, how valid it is, failure to follow state regulations is a violation of federal due process. So I'm going to require,
But at least the theory of the complaint was that the failure to follow the correct procedures violated due process, and therefore there was a 1983 claim.
Enough to keep the right.
That's really the only claim in the original complaint.
That's the only that the procedural due process was being violated.
Was the only claim in the original complaint.
And which, as I understand, the original complaint.
And that is that is what maintained the status quo. Then all these other things developed
then
after that.
Exactly, Your Honor. That's what happened. And it wasn't. And indeed, the district court at one point observed when
well,
it sort of.
If at least there's a colorable argument that was based on 1983, why doesn't that support a fee award?
Your Honor, that might well, as the First Circuit indicated, might. I'm not conceding the point, might support a fee award against the school committee. But the school committee has already settled this matter. And you know what the school committee is paying for is for the fees for the preliminary injunction by their agreement, fees for the preliminary injunction and fees for the hearing before the school committee. And what the plaintiffs are trying to obtain from the commissioner are fees for the hearing which the commissioner conducted. You know, and perhaps he ruled in favor of the school committee, but he ruled that was the position of the school committee. I think we were just acting in a straightforward judicial capacity.
Mr. Avila, why did the Court of Appeals not address the Maher versus Gagne type approach and talk about the substantiality of the constitutional claim and the meritorious nature of the statutory claim under 504?
Well, I think, Your Honor, they do mention that decision. And why they did not follow it is simply this. In this case, as the plaintiffs, as the petitioners indicate, they are not arguing that the Education for All Handicapped Children's Act is enforceable under 1983. You know, that would be the straightforward way to get fees, to argue that it's enforceable under 1983, and therefore under 1988 you should get fees. But they never raised that issue in this case. So I'd respectfully submit they're trying to bring the fee award in through a constitutional back door. What they're saying is...
Well, my question was just why you think the Court of Appeals didn't come to grips with
I think the they did come to grips with it, Your Honor. What they did is they said that if you have an action that's entirely bottomed on a federal act such as the 1983 action, which in itself, in their judgment, wouldn't be enforceable under 1983. They in essence felt that if you couldn't find any congressional intent to enforce it through 1983, you shouldn't be allowed to take a backdoor approach.
But do you think that is consistent with the approach in Maher versus Gagne?
I think it is, Your Honor, when you're dealing with a case where, in our judgment, the constitutional claims are really the same, they're consubstantial. They're really the same claim as the statutory claim. It's not really that they are in any way different. In this case, the handicapped procedure, those administrative regulations, and all that was resolved in that process, who was responsible for educating that child. That was resolved through a statutory procedure.
Well, if there's no repeal of 1983 by implication, in effect, for these purposes, and the two avenues of relief are open, then you have to determine the substantiality of the 1983 claim, I guess.
Well, I think
if that's your position.
Well, I think there are two positions there. You know, I would argue that in fact, you have to look at the Education for All Handicapped Children's Act as having preclusive effect. Just looking at the wide-ranging nature of that act,
a Brown versus GSA type
approach? This act is obviously meant, it prescribes things that are never going to be prescribed constitutionally. It involves development of individualized education programs and provision of related services. It's a very, very comprehensive act, and I just don't see how 1983 comes into play when you have.
I didn't think the Court of Appeals held that there wouldn't be a 1980
83 action, or that it didn't hold that this act precluded any parallel remedies anywhere else. They just said it precluded attorney's fees.
I wouldn't.
And that's the issue in the case.
Well, what they were saying is that the only reason why these constitutional claims were added from the commissioner's perspective was sort of transparently, I would suggest, for the purpose of getting attorney's fees. The interesting sort of issue in the case is this. You could raise this sort of constitutional issue, whatever it may have been. I don't think in my mind it was ever, assuming that it existed, was ever that well articulated. And, you know, there's no real way that anyone could ever get at it. I think that in the old Seiler case, this court established a rule about avoiding deciding constitutional questions. And the purpose of that rule was because the court, for prudential reasons, wanted to turn away from deciding those issues, recognizing the problems you get in with constitutional constructions. When you've got a federal statute like the Handicapped Children's Act, it's so wide-ranging. Realistically, no one is turning away from deciding a difficult constitutional issue. That's not really involved in the case. Everyone's attention is simply focused on the statute. So, that rule about it seems to be potentiating here into something that it was never intended to involve, a fee award question. What I'm suggesting is that when the alleged 1983 constitutional claim is coextensive with the Education for All Handicapped Children's Act, we don't believe that the 1988 fee provision is applicable. I also want to point out briefly, Your Honor, that we raised the contention that the commissioner here is not liable for fees because he was acting in a judicial capacity. And I won't belabor that point. I just want to point out that we would contend that if administrative hearing officers are going to be put in a position where they or their agencies are going to have to pay fees depending upon how they decide the case, that's not really going to contribute to fair and equal due process for anyone. Finally, Your Honors, I'd like to suggest that this court's recent decision in the Pennhurst case may have some applicability to this matter. To the extent that this question was ultimately decided on state law grounds, that decision suggests that perhaps the federal district court shouldn't have gotten involved in the matter in the first place, at least in relation to the commissioner's decision. Now, we have to concede that we're here on a motion for attorney's fees, but I would suggest that if there's some 11th Amendment immunity applicable in this case, that it should be applicable even now on the question of attorney's fees, because the effectiveness of that ruling would best serve by avoiding, by nullifying federal judicial actions, which in essence, on the basis of a state Supreme Court decision, goes out of its way to reverse, for no very good reason perhaps, a decision of an administrative hearing officer.
Would that argument suggest that it was error for the district court to certify the question it did to the Rhode Island Supreme Court?
That might be true. I'm hard pressed to say that since in the original case, I was the one that moved it in the first place, and we thought it was a serious issue that should be decided by the Rhode Island Supreme Court.
But in retrospect, it seems you were quite wrong, doesn't it?
Well,
Pennhurst.
Well, Pennhurst was, could have been. Could be wrong, but I think that it was something we'd still have to do again because it's a vital state issue, and Rhode Island Supreme Court had to have the final say on that issue. No further questions.
I have nothing further, Mr. Larson.
Yes, Mr. Chief Justice.
My adversary seemed to imply that the claims in this case, the 504 claims and the constitutional claims, were kind of backdoor claims to get attorney's fees. I respectfully disagree. This is an exclusion case. There could be no stronger case for an equal protection claim on this record. The original complaint sought relief under the Constitution in general, and it did specify due process. The subsequent complaints can all be read as having, no question about it, an equal protection claim in it. The 504 claim is as substantial as a 504 claim can be. This is, again, an exclusion case. The language of 504 bars exactly what happened in this case, exclusion on the basis of handicap. Now, as attorneys representing plaintiffs, we have the responsibility to allege not only substantial claims, but claims which we believe we can win on. In this case, we had three sets of winning.
Weren't you obliged to allege them in the original complaint?
The 504 claim could have been alleged in the original complaint.
But
no, we were not obliged to do it.
You mean you should hold one of them back?
There was no intentional holding back, Your Honor.
For sandbagging purposes?
No, this was no sandbagging, Your Honor.
For fee purposes?
No, Your Honor. The fees were, in this case, from the beginning, to the extent that there was a substantial constitutional claim stated on the face of the initial complaint. I should also point out that the trial court here made as an ultimate finding of fact, a finding that the equal protection claim was substantial. That was deferred to, a similar finding was deferred to in the majority opinion by this court in Maher v. Gagne in footnote 10, and in the concurring opinion by Mr. Justice Powell, there was a statement saying that we have no occasion to, because of the settlement, to evaluate further the constitutional cause of action. There is no question that plaintiffs were prevailing plaintiffs in this case. I'd also like to address the fact with regard to a question that Justice Powell raised with me earlier about the chronology. I'm not sure that I answered it quite clearly enough. The state defendants were added in this case after the administrative procedures had been exhausted, prior to the certification order. And as Mr. Avila pointed out, it was the respondents who came in and sought the certification. Plaintiffs had three winning federal claims, and we were more than happy to win on any one of those claims. But the trial court, in a model of deference to comity and to federalism, did grant the certification order. No Pennhurst issue was involved in this case whatsoever. Instead, what the court did was it avoided not only the federal statutory issues, but it also avoided the constitutional issue. This court only yesterday in Escambia County cited with approval Ashwander once again in order to avoid deciding unnecessarily.
Mr. Larson, how can you say there was no Pennhurst issue? How can you say that? He based the decision on state law when he could have done it on federal grounds, and there was a state defendant in the case.
There is no.
Why isn't that directly, isn't that exactly what Pennhurst prohibits?
No federal court interpretation whatsoever of the state law. It's a certification that happened on defendant's application.
Well, I know it was done on defendant's application, but it doesn't mean it's consistent with Pennhurst, does it?
Pennhurst, for 11th Amendment purposes, as I understand Pennhurst, bars a federal court order based upon state law, an injunctive order requiring state officials to comply with state law. There is no such order in this case. Jurisdiction was alleged solely on our 1983, 504, and 75 education.
Well, I thought earlier in the argument was developed that all of the relief was based entirely on state law as you eventually got through. That
plaintiffs
right.
obtained the objective sought in this lawsuit.
Against state defendants based on state law in a federal court.
As a result of a state court ruling.
But the Court of Appeals said the relief really rested on a federal statute.
In their second opinion, yes, they did.
And so they reinterpreted the whole run of events and said that it was under the Education for the
Handicapped
Act.
The State of Rhode Island decision, because it starts out with several paragraphs discussing the federal law.
Could you tell me in a word why you think you're entitled to fees for the state administrative proceedings?
It gets into an interpretation of this court's decision in New York Gaslight versus Carey as to whether or not there has to be a mandatory exhaustion proceeding or whether fees are also available.
Yeah, but the mandatory exhaustion proceeding is under a statute that doesn't provide for fees.
That issue is not before this court. That's something the First Circuit would have to deal with on remand. It was raised before the First Circuit and not reached by the First Circuit.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in Block against...